great honor to be able to just share with you our heart, our passion for Senegal, and we'll look tonight at some principles of things we've learned in Senegal and some of the experiences we had. You can join me in 2 Kings chapter 5. Now, I will say, if you're on staff here, just because I'm wearing this boo-boo, don't get any ideas that you can get up and preach without a tie. Okay, Pastor, I don't want to set that precedent here. You just come up here. This is tuxedo level clothing in Senegal. Okay, this is high end. I probably paid as much as over there as I would for a suit here. So this is a really nice outfit over there. Okay, now, even after telling the story at a church I was just at recently, I told the whole story about, you know, it's not a dress, it's not pajamas. There was this church I was just at. I warned them. I said, I'm going to wear my boo-boo tonight. And I came back wearing the boo-boo. And this young girl who was in junior church, so she didn't hear the story. She comes up to me and just all innocent and everything. And she just says, and I think she went to public school, so she thought it was real. She said, well, that is the nicest nightgown I've ever seen. And I said, well, that's a new one. And you're a little kid. I'll let it slide. All right. You come to Senegal, we'll get you a custom boo-boo made, and you can get up here and preach it. Wonderful. Now, I will say, I mentioned this morning, sometimes your first term can be a little bit of disorientation. You're trying to get used to the culture and the country. And I'll tell you, even to this day, there's still things you experience. I remember we were driving back and forth between our house and the capital. It's about 4 hours. And right in the middle, there's this police checkpoint. And they're pulling everybody over. They're trying to, and I learned early on, boy, they're going to find something. And so they'll walk around the car and they're looking at things and turn your blinker on, turn this blinker on, turn your brake lights on, open up your back. All right, where's your car jack? Here it is. All right, where is your fire extinguisher? Oh, it's right here. And he's like, okay, where's your triangle? You got to have that reflective triangle. I said, it's right here. I got it all, sir. He said, where's your second triangle? I said, I don't have a second triangle. He said, I got you. Wrote me a ticket. All right, so tickets are around $6. They're not a big deal. So anyways, I got this spiel down. As I learned the language, I started working on this thing I would do. And I get pulled over, start speaking Wolof. And, of course, a white guy speaking Wolof, it's interesting. Not too many white people go there and learn the language. A lot of French don't bother at all. And so it's always a thing. And so I pulled over and Salam alaikum, alaikum salam, nagadef. Ah, you're speaking Wolof. Yeah, I speak Wolof. Ah, okay, where are you from? And I'll say, I'm from Indar. Oh, you're from San Luis, from Indar. You must be in Domu Indar. They'll say, ah, son of Indar. I'll say, yes, I'm a son of Indar. And if you come, my wife will make you Chebindar, which is the Chebujin, the national dish. Our city is known for making the best Chebujin in the world. And so I would have this joke. Yeah, I would kind of kid with them. You come and my wife will make you the best Chebujin in the world. And you can come. Your wife makes Chebujin. Yeah. And then we'd have a good laugh. And then they'd say, all right, go ahead and get out of here. So after I started getting more comfortable and speaking Wolof better, well, I was paying less and less tickets because they kind of joke around. Then I got to know them real well. And so anyways, but even after that, there's still things that come up. I'm pulling up. And we're getting up to the checkpoint. This is just a couple months before we came back. And we always kind of, with our kids, as we're driving, like, are we going to get pulled over or not? There he is. So we pull up, and it was a new guy. I didn't recognize him. I know most of the officers there. And he sees me, and he goes, pull over. Yeah, okay, so I pull over. He walks up. I'm getting my whole spiel ready. I was Chebujin and Dar and all that. All right, here we go. I roll down the window. He says, you know why I pulled you over? I said, no, sir. He said, because you didn't turn on your blinker when I pulled you over. And I went, wait, what? What did you just say? He said, you didn't turn your blinker on when I pulled you over. That's an infraction. He wrote me a ticket. I said, what? And then a guy that I did know, he comes running around. I said, no, this is Dauda. My name there is Dauda. David, which is my middle name. And that's a funny thing, too, is when we got there, the missionary I was supposed to work with ended up leaving the field right before we got there. And we have a similar build, about the same height. I'm a little taller. And in Africa, it's not racist, but all white people kind of look the same, all right? Just the way it is. And so people are always like, are you this guy? No, no. Do you know him? No. And so I remember our first year we were there. Now, my middle name's David, and this missionary's middle name was David. And so he went by the Wolof name for David is Dauda. So he went by Dauda. And I remember no one had called me Dauda yet, but I knew Dauda was David. And this older man comes around the corner one day, our first year we're there, and he sees me, he goes, oh, Dauda. I'm so happy to see you. It's been such a long time. I went, oh yeah, it's good to see you too. And he said, how are your kids? And I'm thinking, I only have one kid. And then he said, oh, I'm just, and he's almost got tears in his eyes. I can't believe you're back. And I'm so happy to see you again. And we were so far in the conversation before I realized he thinks I'm the other missionary. And it was just a neighbor, not a church member or anything. And I didn't have the heart to tell him it's not me. So I just went along with it. Oh, I'm doing great. And say hi to your family for me and all that. And so doubt is stuck. From that day on, I was Doubt, all right, my middle name. So anyway, just the learning the culture and adapting and all of that, it's important. But at the end of the day, we're there to get the gospel. Get the gospel to people. I love the stories in the Bible. Look, what... one of the things you'll learn about missions is it's not just for the missionary, but God has an unfinished task, a mission for every one of us that started back in Genesis 3:15. And we're continuing to this day. I love the fact that the book of Acts doesn't, it just ends abruptly. It just says, hey, this is it. Why? Because it's still going. God, the pen of Acts is still being written. The Acts of the Holy Spirit is working in hearts and lives of people around the world. Is still taking place. And God desires every single one of us to be involved in His story of what He's doing. It's just amazing when you surrender your life daily to God's calling and pursue Him, how God opens doors and gets you in on what He's doing. It's just incredible. I love the stories of the Bible. Because we see they're not just great stories, you know, some of the best stories in the world. Hollywood has a hard time keeping up. In fact, they steal most of the narratives of the Bible, right? All the greatest stories told were written in the Bible, and they're not just great because they're heroic and they're amazing and they're great, but they're true. But even more than that, the Bible tells us they're given for our admonishment and for our encouragement to show us what we ought to do and a lot of times what not to do, okay? Well, tonight's a story of what we should do and how God took the testimony of a little girl and used it in a great way. I love the stories of the Bible because we see God's hand working in individual lives. I remember when we first arrived to Senegal, we decided after a term there, we're going to plant a church. We're going to start from scratch in a part of town where there's no other churches yet. And so I'm getting excited. We built a building. God allowed us to raise enough funds to build this building. And we're going to use this building as a tool to reach people. We built it like a house because we're in a tight-knit neighborhood. You take one step out of our house, about three steps out of the front door, and you're in the neighbor's house. We're two doors down from the local mosque. And so it's a very tight-knit neighborhood. Everybody's Muslim in our neighborhood. And I was starting, as we were finishing up the first floor, where we're going to have Bible studies, film nights. We're going to have a library. A lot of what the missionaries before us did, we're moving to this part of town. We're going to do Bible studies, kids clubs, film nights, all kinds of activities to share the gospels. And I'm starting to get nervous as we're opening up. Man, how are people going to respond? You know, once they find out what our intentions are, that we're here to share the gospel and all of this. And so I'm walking up to the door one day, and all the men in our neighborhood are gathered around my front door. And I thought, oh no, they found out what we're going to do, and they're going to run us off. You know, what's going to happen? And as I got closer, there was an older gentleman sitting on the front porch in front of our house with talking to all the men on our street. I'd never seen him before. And he looked over and saw me walking up, and he said, hey, Tubob, white guy, hey, Tubob, do you know Ron Bragg? I said, yeah, Ron Bragg. He's the director of our mission, and he used to live here. He said, I know, he was my neighbor. He was the greatest Tubob I ever knew. He was the nicest guy. My kids would play with his kids, and we'd eat together, and then he was the greatest guy I ever knew. He said, do you know La Mission Baptiste, the Baptist mission? I said, yeah, that's what we are. That's what we're doing. Everything Ron Bragg did, we're doing here. We're going to have a library and all this. This guy I'd never seen before. Never seen him after. Turned to all my neighbors. He said, this is a good work. You get behind him. You support him. Don't ever cause him any trouble. This is a good man, and this is a good work. And you, if he needs anything, you help him out. And they're all nodding their heads, and I'm nodding my head. Yeah, that's good. Listen to him. That's really good. And I never saw, he left, never saw him after that. I called my wife and said, I'm starting right now. I'm opening the doors. We are moving forward. God's hand in that. It's amazing in just so many situations how you, when you just plug into what God is doing. But the situations in our life are not always pleasant. And I could share just as many stories of some difficult times that we faced on the mission field. Not unique, yes, because it is a different culture, and there are difficulties of trying to deal with things. I don't have time, but I'll tell you, Sarah and Daniel came, and they went through an ordeal while they were with us. And we almost lost Sarah. And just a procedure, just to give a quick recap, a lady in our church took her husband's car out and hit a wall. She didn't know how to drive. I don't know why she's taking her husband's car out. And I repaired the wall, went in and asked, oh, what do you guys do here anyways? They said, oh, we're midwives, this and that. 6 months later, Daniel and Sarah were with us, and she had a medical emergency, and we needed very specific doctor, and it was midnight, and we couldn't find where this doctor was. I had his card, but nobody would answer. I didn't know where he was. And I thought, oh, wait, that wall I just finished, they're midwives. Maybe they would know where to find. So I drove there and said, can you help her? They said, we can't help her. And she was on the brink of death. And I know he shared the story on our podcast. You can hear more stories. We have a podcast. Go back and listen to the episode with Daniel. But they said, we can't help her, but why don't you go to this doctor? And we said, that's who we're looking for. They said, oh, we'll take you to him right over here. Took him to her. And he came in and he saved her life. She needed two blood transfusions. And the fact that, I'll tell you, what the ordeal they went through. Listen to go back and listen. It's on all the podcast streams. The fact they're still on the field is an incredible testament to their faith in the Lord. So not all situations are pleasant, but you've got to step back and see God's hand. I love this story in the Bible. I love the characters we are introduced in verse 1. Now Naaman, we're introduced to the captain of the king of Syria. The Bible says he's a great man with his master and honorable because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was a mighty man in valor, and then it ends, but he was a leper. Naaman, we are introduced to the first character. He is a mighty man with a great need, but with no solution to that need. Naaman represents really the average successful person in this world. That's without God. That's without Christ. Notice his achievement. The Bible says by him, he had great honor. He was great with his master. He was a man of position, a general. He was a man of character and integrity. The Bible said that he was honorable because by him the Lord had given deliverance. Most Muslims you interact with are just regular people trying to live their life, raise their families that need the Lord. And most people you interact with are just trying to do the best they can. Here is Naaman, a good man. But he doesn't know what he doesn't know. He doesn't know what he's missing. He doesn't know the Lord. He's doing the best he can. He represents your average successful person with great achievement, great position, great character. And yet at the end of the day, what does the Bible say? He's a leper. I can imagine a guy like Naaman, who's used to being in command, used to being in control, and he's got this disease that is incurable, that there's nothing he can do about it. There's no cure. I would imagine he's trying to keep an image, so he probably keeps his armor on as much as he can, trying to cover up. I'm sure he's been to the temple of his God to try to figure out some sort of cure. Of course, this God he's worshiped hasn't helped him at all, but he's going through the motions. And with all of his achievement, with all of his greatness, with all that we see, he's a good man, but at the end of the day, he is a leper and there's nothing he can do about it. At least that he thinks that he can do about it. And it doesn't matter the people you interact with. Most people are pretty good people. Most people are just trying to live their life, getting by, decent people. In fact, a lot of people aren't miserable, really. A lot of people are just, I'm good, you know. But they don't know what they're missing. At the end of the day, we lay our head down on the pillow. We're all in that same situation. We're all sinners. And there's nothing we can do about it. So here's Naaman, a decent guy, great guy, but he's got a big need and no solution to that need. And he represents what this world is. With all their achievements, with all the civilizations and the kingdoms we've built, with all that we've accomplished in this world, at the end of the day, if you die a sinner, you die without hope for eternity. And then we're introduced, secondly, to a little girl who's put into a bad situation but has a big God. Bible says in verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out by companies and brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife, and she said unto her mistress, would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy. So I like to put myself in the shoes of these situations. I made movies growing up. I never thought I'd use it in the ministry, but then it became a thing where we're doing a lot of media. We produce a lot of different films and outreach and things like that. But I love story. I love telling story. I love writing story. And so I love the stories of the Bible. I remember as a kid hearing these stories, and I would put myself in their shoes. So put yourself in their shoes. Here you are, just a young girl. Her age isn't given, but she's maybe a young teenager, maybe even a child. We don't know. Young teenager. Early 20s. Here she is at home with her family, just enjoying maybe a meal with her family. And yes, the Syrians every once in a while cross over the border. They'll kind of rob and steal, and there's always this constant conflict. But you're not thinking much of it. And as you're in the middle of a meal, in bursts the Syrian army. Soldiers burst in, interrupting your meal. Your father stands up to defend the family, and they throw him down. They grab your mom and push her aside. They start ransacking the house. You're absolutely terrified. A big soldier comes up, wraps you up, puts a bag over your head, brings you outside, puts you on the back of the horse, and off you go. By the time you're in a foreign country, you're in a foreign land, this is not your people, you have no idea, is my family still alive or not? Imagine the fear that's just gripping you. Where am I? What am I doing here? What have they done to my family? Why is this happening to me? And to make matters worse, to add insult to injury, this little girl who's taken and kidnapped from her family is made a slave girl. But more than that, she's made a slave girl of the very man who sanctioned the attack in the first place. The general of the army. The guy's whose fault it is that she's in this situation. Now, if anybody has precedent to be bitter and upset about the situation that they found themselves in, it'd be this little girl. If anybody has an excuse to say, to even be upset at God, why on earth would you allow this to happen to me? What did I do? You would expect hostility rooted in confusion and fear and bitterness, not empathy and compassion and kindness. In fact, if I was this little girl, I'd be in a room. Naaman gets home, and he throws his armor in there. I'm supposed to wash it. You know, I'd be in there washing, just angry and upset. I can't leave this guy. He hurt my family and made me a slave. And I'd just be in there, you know, angry and upset. And then I would hear he's in there, you know, as all guys do. We're tough when we're around other guys, and we're tough when we're out, you know, in public. But any little, you stub your toe, and so, oh, honey, please come and help. You know, we're wimps at home and all that. So he's sitting at home, and he said, oh, this leprosy is awful. It's itchy so bad, and I think I'm starting to lose my finger, and oh, it's just horrible, it's just bad. Now, if I was this little girl hearing Naaman in there complaining, I'd be saying, good, I hope it eats away at you, I hope it hurts, I hope it's itchy, I hope you're in the middle of a battle, and you have to itch your nose, and you can't itch it, and you get distracted. In fact, I hope your nose falls off. That'd probably be how I'd be responding, all right? I wouldn't be too happy about the situation. But she didn't respond that way. Sometimes life doesn't turn out the way we expect it should or would. Sometimes God has different plans for us. But no matter how life turns out, whatever situation God allows you to pass through, He has one will for you. That is to pursue Jesus and to make Him known. In any situation. How on earth is a world without Jesus supposed to know how to handle loss and tragedy and difficulty if we don't pass through it and show them how a Christian ought to behave when we pass through those difficulties? So God allows bad things to happen to His children so He can draw others to Himself. But we got to make a choice in that moment. I think about a young man, shared his testimony. This young man from, I think it was Uganda or Kenya somewhere, he ended up getting a scholarship, went to a university, but the majority of students were Muslim at this university. He was excited to have a chance to share my faith. And he was getting ready. He had Muslim friends, so he knew kind of the interaction. We ended up getting roomed with a couple guys, one of them who said he was pretty radical in his practice of Islam. He said, I was taught to hate Christians. And he said about a week in, he learned that this roommate was Christian. And he gathered up his buddies and said, we're going to kill this guy. He has no place here. They took him out into the woods and they beat him and left him for dead. Now, things didn't turn out the way he'd expected. Okay, he crawled out of there. He actually survived it, crawled out of there, found a village nearby, was nursed back to health, and then went home. Things sometimes don't turn out the way we expect it. And this little girl, I feel, humanly speaking, has every right to be hostile, has every right to be upset. And yet in her captivity, she decides, I'm going to be compassionate and kind. And instead of responding with bitterness, when she hears the plight of Naaman, she says, oh, ma'am, if you could get Naaman to the prophet in Israel, he's done some incredible miracles. We serve the true and living God. If Naaman could just get to God, God could do something incredible in his life. The Bible says in verse 4, and one went in and told his Lord, saying, thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel. And so we're introduced, secondly, we see a simple testimony causes a great controversy, but initiates a spiritual journey toward salvation. This simple testimony causes a great controversy, but it initiates a spiritual journey toward salvation. Sharing Christ will always stir up controversy, all right? Now, we ought to be Christ-like, but at the end of the day, when you stand for truth, that is what the world hates. Right? Now, be Christ-like. Don't be obnoxious in it, all right? But whether you're obnoxious or not, they're still going to hate you for what you stand for. So it'd be better off if you're persecuted for righteousness and for being a Christ-like individual than being obnoxious. All right, but the point is, when you stand for truth, it's going to cause a stirring controversy. And here, this little girl gives a very simple testimony. Just get to the prophet, he'll recover him. And in this spiritual journey that begins, we see a king's demand. The king says in verse 5, the king of Syria said, go to, I'll send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him 10,000 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, 10 changes of raiment. So here's this pagan king. Naaman goes and says, hey, I want to take a trip to Israel. This girl says something about a prophet and I could be healed. It's worth a shot. The king says, all right, I'll write a letter. I got some sway. I'm a powerful king. I'll write a letter and they'll have to listen and do what I say. This pagan king, in his arrogance, decides their God will do what I say if I demand it. This pagan king who worships a pagan God, by the way, who has done absolutely nothing to help the actual plight that Naaman is in. But oh yeah, God will do what I want because I said to do it. God does not meet us at our demands. Okay? God does not meet us on our terms. All right. And so, When you're interacting, whether with an atheist or with Muslims or other believers, you don't have to bring God down to their terms and meet them at their terms. But what we like to do is get to the heart of it. Let's talk about you as an individual, and let's get to your needs, and let's get the gospel to you. And so here this king writes this letter. We see a king in despair, verse 6 and 7. This is so sad. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant unto thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy. And it came to pass, when the king of Israel, who understands the rich history of his nation, who understands we have the true and living God, who delivered us from Egypt and parted the Red Sea and sent down all these plagues, the king of Israel, who ought to know better, who should respond, this is an incredible opportunity to share the mighty power of God with your enemy. And here's his response. When he got the letter, it was read to the king that he rent his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore, consider, I pray you, see how he seeketh a quarrel against me. He's like, what? Am I God? No, you're not. Okay, nobody's asking you to heal him. He says, no, he's trying to, right away, he missed the point of what God was doing, and he made it all political. I think you should get involved in politics, but I think Christians get carried away sometimes. All right? He said, he's just trying to start a fight. We got to come up with a political policy to be this and that. Our hope is not in the policies passed by the way of our government. Our hope is not in the leadership we elect. None of that. Do your best. Try to put the best guy in you can. But that's not where the hope in the nation is. God is going to work with or without America. God is going to do his work. And he says, my God, his response revealed his proximity to God. He wasn't walking with God. And the Bible continues and we see a prophet's declaration. Verse 7, after he had rent his clothes, he said, oh, he's just looking for a quarrel. Verse 8, it was so when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king saying, wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. I love that. His response reveals his proximity to the Lord. He said, let him come. Bring it. Bring it. Let him come. We serve. Did you forget who we serve? Did you forget that God that created us is the God that chose us and separated us? And that this is His work anyways? Have you forgotten all that? Yeah, but it's scary. He's a scary man. He's a big, big scary man. Okay, I don't know if we can do this. We have God on our side, all right? And whatever God declares, whatever God decrees, and whatever God desires, He's going to do it. And He's on our side. Let Him come. Let's do it. Let's get this task done. And so He shows up. And I love this because Naaman, on this spiritual journey, he has a lot he had to overcome. And after living in Senegal for a long time, working among Muslims, there's a lot that has to be overcome before they can even begin to comprehend what the gospel is all about. There's a lot that Naaman had to overcome. And I think about just even after I've spoke with young men, Muslims, that have said, I believe the gospel is true, that Jesus died. I believe everything you're saying, but my family will kill me. I can't follow Jesus at this time. They will kill me. And there's been a lot of opposite. We've seen men beaten and poisoned and just this immediate response to those who decide to follow Jesus. I think of a gentleman named Abdu Malik was at a seminar recently and they were sharing how in North Africa, and actually this December I'm flying back to Senegal and I'll be going to Gambia for a week. We're doing an Islamic evangelism seminar at Daniel's Church. And then I'm meeting with three guys who work with thousands of Fulani across North Africa. Now, the Fulani are part of the Boko Haram. They're the more strict Muslims. But we've noticed there's a phenomenon in the Islamic world where Islam is more violently practiced. More people are getting saved. It's interesting. Senegal is much more tolerant. Everybody's laid back. Hey, we can all be friends. We're cool. Unless you're Muslim, you get saved. Then it's a whole other story. But just in general, like, hey, we're all good. We can get along and all this and that. But where it's more violently practiced, there's thousands getting saved. Malik went to this conference where they were sharing all that. I'll be meeting with three guys who work with Christians across. We're going to help set them up. We started an online media already, and many thousands are following that who are throughout North Africa and this people group. And so they told Malik at this meeting, we've been using your material to help disciple and evangelize people. And we didn't even know that they had been taking that and using it. And so Malik was pumped after that. But just God is at work among those people. And at the seminar, a gentleman stood up and shared his testimony. He said, I grew up just, I was very strict in a very radical Islamic family. And Abdu said, I did everything I could to go against Christians. I hated Christians. I did everything I could. I'd persecute and attack. I mean, just everything. And then he got saved. It's an incredible. I don't have time for his whole salvation testimony. But he ended up getting saved. And immediately, after all this that he had to overcome, he didn't know how his family would respond. And when they found out, his dad said, all right, you're out. He said, thankfully, he didn't kill me. But he said, my dad did something, and I'd never heard this before. He said he gathered all the family, all the neighbors, all the surrounding tribes, and announced my funeral. And he said, I stood at the top of a hill and looked down as hundreds gathered for my funeral. And my dad said, he's dead. He's gone. And they did this whole funeral. And he said, when everybody dispersed, I went down there, and he said, I was weeping, sitting in front of my tombstone. He said, I had never felt so alone. But then he said, I felt like somebody put their hand on my shoulder. And he said, I turned around, nobody was there. But he said, this overwhelming peace and comfort came over me, that I'm not alone. And he was able to escape out of there. And he made his way up to Germany. And he got some training in a Bible college up there. And now he's traveling around preaching. But when you work with certain groups, there's a lot to be overcome. Naaman had a lot he had to overcome. And you don't know the person that you're interacting with, you don't know what stage of journey they're in, and they're in God drawing them. Your job is just get them to Jesus and be a shining light in their situation. He had a lot to overcome. Look, first he had to overcome the belief that God's favor can be bought. He shows up with all this silver and gold and changes the clothes. The Bible says in verse 9, he shows up, Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of Elisha. So he shows up with all of his entourage. He shows up with all this money and he's ready to buy this miracle. And the first thing he has to overcome is that God's favor cannot be bought. Your good works are not good enough to get you into heaven. Number one, you're incompatible with God. You're like a floppy disk trying to plug into a USB-C, all right? It ain't gonna work. You're incompatible because God is holy and you are not. So your good works are even filthy rags because your good works are tainted by the fact that you are a sinner. You have nothing to offer God. And you know why good works don't work anyways? Why you can't buy your way into heaven? Because if I got to heaven and God said, oh, let's check. Oh, you did just enough good works to get into heaven. You know what I get to do for eternity? I get to walk around and see that. You see what I did to get into this place? You see what a great guy I am? I don't know about you, but Brother Jensen, he don't want to spend eternity with me bragging about how great a guy I am, okay? No, no, no. I come to heaven saying, I have nothing to offer. I'm just a worm. I had even my righteousness are filthy rags. But Jesus came down and he took my sin and he bore that burden on the cross and he bore the wrath of God on his shoulders and he died for me. I was there. He took my place and now he rose again and he received me and my confession of him. I'm saved forever. I'm a child of God. And for all eternity, I get to go around heaven saying, look how good my God is. Look what he did to get me in here. Look the price he paid. Look how great a good God he is. You can't buy it. You can't earn it. He offers it freely. And he had to overcome that. He had to overcome the fact that he was looking for a religious ritual to perform, not a truth to believe and obey. He was looking for a ritual. Look at verse 10. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him saying, go and wash in Jordan 7 times and thy flesh shall come again unto thee and thou shalt be clean. But Naaman was wroth and went away and he said, behold, I thought, there's his first problem, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike his hand over this place and recover the leper. God's dealing with his pride, all right? I am a general and he hasn't even come out to greet me. Elisha's not even leaving his house. He sends his servant. Who does he think he is? Does he know who I am? I thought he would come out here. And I don't know what kind of TV he's getting there in Syria, but he's been watching a little bit too much Benny Hinn. He said, I thought he was going to come out and he was going to stomp his feet and clap his hands and strike me on the forehead and I'd have a seizure and I'd be healed. You know, like that's what he was expecting. He was looking for a ritual to perform. Right. Name it. Elisha doesn't even come out of the house. He says, just go wash in the Jordan. He was looking for a religious ritual to perform. He had to overcome his own bias and his own preference and his own culture. Christianity's for the white people. We hear that all the time. How many times do you hear that in Africa growing up, all right? Christianity's for the white people. All right. He had to overcome. He said, are my rivers, Arna, Abana, verse 12, and far, far rivers of Damascus where I'm from, are they not much better? They are objectively better. Well, they are. The Jordan's kind of murky and muddy and it's not that great. But we didn't say go wash there. You wash in the Jordan. Be clean. And he's angry. He had to overcome all that. God's breaking his pride down. Okay. And he's ready to turn away and he went away in a rage, the Bible says. He's upset. And finally, a servant approaches him. And lastly, he had to overcome the simplicity of the message. The simplicity of the message. A servant approaches him in verse 13 and said, Hey, Naaman, if they had asked you to do some great feat, perform some great ritual, if they asked you to climb up this mountain and find this special rose and come down and turn it into a tea and drink and you know, do all this, if they told you to do all this, would you have done this great act? Oh, yeah, I would have, certainly. He said, well, all he said is go wash and be clean. Why don't you just go try it? He had to overcome the simplicity of the message. Just wash and be clean. And fortunately, Naaman relents. And he makes his way down. And you know the story. He gets down into that water. It's murky. Hands his shirt off to his worker there. steps his foot in. It's all, you know, when you step in that murky river water and all that oozes, the mud oozes in your toes. You're, oh, it's disgusting. You know, he's stepping down in there. I'm sure he's complaining a little bit. It's cold. He finally gets in deep enough. All right, what'd they say? A couple times? No, seven times. You got to dip seven times. Seven. All right, whatever. He makes that first dip. He's got seaweed all over him. He's throwing it off. Second dip. He's looking down. Nothing's happening. Seven times, Nathan. You got to do what he said. Seven times. It's real simple. Just seven times. Three, four, five. He's starting to feel something. I don't know how it works, if it was immediate or what, but maybe he's starting getting a little tingly feeling or something. He goes down the seventh time. He comes up kind of in slow motion. Everything just kind of pauses. He's shaking the water off. The sun's glistening off him, you know. He looks down. It's gone. The leprosy's gone. In fact, the Bible says that when he came out of the water, he dipped himself seven times and his flesh came again like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. He's looking down. It's gone. It's gone. It worked. He said, it's so soft. Okay, guys, relax. All right. He goes back, and here's where the real miracle takes place. That's cool. He got healed from leprosy. That's awesome. Here's where the real miracle takes place. Verse 15, and he returned to the man of God, he and all his company. And he came and stood before him, and he said, behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth, but in Israel. He got saved. This man overcomes all that. Look, salvation is simple. Just believe, you'll be saved. Trust Christ. Look, God is complex. See, religion, false religion, makes salvation and the practice of religion complex, and God is real simple. The truth of the Bible is God is very complex. He's somebody we'll be studying for eternity, getting to know. But his salvation, real simple. The way he provides salvation, complex. That he dealt with that. But the way we receive it, it's just a free gift. That's it. That's it. And we think, man, that's amazing. Boy, Lord, would you just call more missionaries? We need more men of God to go out there and preach the word. Wait. What I love about this story is the man of God. We do need more men of God. We need more missionaries. We need laborers. We need preachers. But what I love about this story is in Naaman's journey, the man of God doesn't even come out of the house. Okay? He says, I'm sipping some tea right now. Okay, you just go on dip, all right? Sorry, but I'm hoping I'm bad accent. He said, I'm just enjoying my time in here. And he's not even in the picture. How did Naaman go from a general in Syria worshiping a false god to bending his knee to the God of Israel? Because a little girl who was put into a terrible situation that she did not ask for and she did not deserve decided that I'm going to share God. I'm just going to get him to God in my situation. That's my job. That's my calling. Abdu shared after he got saved, he started traveling and preaching in Islamic conferences around North Africa. He said he was in Egypt. And he said, I was preaching. A gentleman approached me about the same age as I am, Abdu said. And Abdu's the one whose father had buried him. Right? He said, after I got done speaking, a gentleman approached me about my age. And he said, do you remember me? He said, oh, should I? Are we from the same village? Like, did we grow up together? He said, you seem familiar, but I don't quite remember you. And the gentleman said, I'm the young man that you took out into the jungle and beat and left for dead at the university. He said, you're still alive? He said, that's been so heavy a burden on my conscience ever since I've been saved, what we did to you. He said, you knew who we were. Why didn't you come back? You could have turned us all in. He said, I know. But he said, I decided from that moment that I survived that, I'm going to pray every day for your salvation. If I would have turned you in, you'd be in a jail cell hating Christians even more. But he decided that in that situation that he didn't ask for and he didn't deserve, that I'm just going to get people to Jesus through that. And so I'm going to call tonight, our calling tonight, and what I want you to consider as Pastor comes to lead the invitation, will you surrender your situation to the Lord to fulfill this mission? Will you surrender your situation, your work, your life, your children, your family, Every aspect, your finances, yes, every part of you, will you surrender that to make Jesus known? Good or bad, come what may, we're just going to make Jesus known to this lost and dying world. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes? Pastor, will you come? Father, thank you for this message. Work in our hearts, and may we be committed to fulfill this task. In Jesus' name, Pastor, would you?